Hello, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Michael and Patty Show. Today, I have our special guest, as always.
Patty?
Did you forget your name?
No, I wasn't sure if this was my opportunity to introduce myself.
It is. We're actually working from another remote location. We're at Powerhouse Patty World Headquarters, testing out a new podcast setup. So if we sound different, that's why.
Yes. And actually, it sounds pretty good in here right now.
Oh, that's good. Why don't you tell us about Powerhouse Realty before we begin in less than 30 seconds?
30 seconds or less. Powerhouse Realty has been open since January 2019. We've been at our current location since July 2021. We are a boutique brokerage that has 15 agents and staff working here. And we are centrally located in a community called Winslow South, which is just outside of Charlottetown.
Sounds good. You're doing a great job. The office looks really good. So if you're new to the podcast, we cover everything Prince Edward Island real estate and PEI in general. You can find us here, of course, and on our YouTube channels, Twitter feeds, Instagram threads, and our weekly newsletters. In addition to that, you can also visit gov.pe.ca and peiplay.com, which has a wonderful selection of a tourist magazine, maps, everything you'd like to know. And I think it's still free, isn't it?
I believe it is still free. That's the one thing I can say. Prince Edward Island has some great platform sites for information.
And if there's anything you would like us to cover on our podcast or see on our YouTube channels, be sure to email it in. We've currently have over 2,000 videos combined with our two channels. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
And over 6,000 subscribers. So thank you for subscribing. Here we go. So point number one is how your will and power of attorneys in place are so important. Just the other day, I was talking to somebody. The mother owns the properties. The father has passed away. And they have a son, daughter, other family. And the first thing I said to them is your will and your power of attorneys, which will actually die with the person, my understanding, correct?
Yes.
Make sure they are in place because it's very important to have those up to date, accurate, and approved by a lawyer so you don't run into problems by the time you come to us to list your property and then everything is in a complete and utter mess.
Yes, having your legal documentation in order is so important. And it's not something that you should only be considering at a retirement age or older. I have lived a life where had I had my legal documentation, my will, my power of attorney, and living power of attorney in place, may have changed some of the circumstances and maybe some of the pain that I had to go through trying to navigate my way through a system, having had my first husband involved in a motorcycle accident. So we cannot stress the importance of having your will and documentation in order, no matter what age you are. And also making sure you have an executor and someone that's able to advocate on your behalf.
There's nothing worse than listing a property for sale after a death has happened, only to find out that the paperwork is not accurate or up to date or valid. And then it can take months or potentially years to close if you have to go through probate and stuff. So get that stuff up to date.
And can I just add one thing on that, Michael? Sometimes it's important to make sure that you allow the information in your will, at the very least, who the executor is. I've had estate sales here on Prince Edward Island where the executor was named after when they read out the will after the loved one had passed, only to create a little bit of chaos and stress when it was the oldest child that didn't get declared the executor, and there was a lot of hard feelings in amongst the children. It was a large family. It just created undue stress on the children as they were disputing, well, why didn't mom pick me type things. Make sure you'll at least let a little bit of the information known. It may save undue stress and a little chaos on the other side.
And that's something we're running into here because, of course, the son and the daughter, and they're both in their 50s or so, are now arguing over who gets what, and I want to live in the house. And I'm thinking, like, shouldn't this have been resolved like 20 years ago?
Yeah, there's been, and I have a really good friend in Ontario, and she's also going through a bit of a situation after losing her mother last year. And one of the issues could have been resolved because the parent, the mother, was gifting the property to one of the daughters. And unfortunately, it's created a bit of stress and chaos. It's been over a year and the property still hasn't been transferred over into this daughter's name. And again, it just creates stress within the relationships of the surviving family members.
And part of this particular estate, many estates, is farmland. So I'm interested in getting your opinion, Patty, on this. We're selling a farm. It's hundreds of acres. The seller or the person managing the estate is asking, should I get the farmland surveyed?
And this is the surviving person still, or is
this
after they've passed?
Let's just refer to them as the seller.
The seller, and has the seller passed, or is they're preparing their will?
They're shaky. It could happen any day.
It would probably be in their best interest to have the property surveyed and have all that documentation in order.
Why?
So that there's no dispute as to property lines, what's being sold, especially if they're aware of who their neighbors are. On the other side, a neighbor could end up disputing, or during the process of having the property go to probate, could end up moving the markers and saying, here's where the actual property line is.
Well, you typically don't see people moving markers in farmland. You see that more in waterfront building lots on the North Shore. In this particular case, it's probably a good idea to have any property surveyed or a plot plan if there's buildings on there, because you know what you're selling and you're not going to run into a lawsuit down the road where you're illustrating things or portraying things to be 100, 200 acres or whatever the case may be, and it's only 75 or 80. A survey is going to validate the deed, or in this case, deeds. From a purchaser's perspective, it's always a great idea to have a survey and or plot plans done. Great answer, Patty.
Yeah, and it depends on how long ago the property was surveyed. Many properties on PEI have been surveyed back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, or just because of the properties around it being surveyed off, it was never officially surveyed. It's just the property lines are established by the adjacent or neighboring properties. So it would be good to have a formal survey on that particular property.
The challenge I run into with properties that are larger acreage is a lot of times, or sometimes, the deeds will refer to things as streams, rivers, wells, fence lines, trees, and all or some of those things may not exist anymore. So what happens is, and they asked this question to me as well, they asked, if the deeds aren't valid, what do you have to do with regards to the boundaries? Well, what you do is you have a boundary agreement or agreements written up. And that can be a timely thing, depending on where your neighbors live, how accessible and agreeable they are to these boundaries. And you would have to basically rewrite one or more deeds to reflect the changes that everyone's agreed on. And I've only had to have that done maybe twice.
Have a boundary agreement. I have seen a piece of land that had been subdivided off, and they were referencing from approximately 100 years ago the fencing for the cattle within the deed for this particular property. So it is a very good idea to have those things updated. Streams may not exist anymore. They may have dried up or moved on further downstream. No pun intended.
You know how many times I've gone out with the metal detector looking for survey markers only to find out someone's buried a fence?
No.
Many, many, many. It's not a good thing, and it's done all the time. It's not so much they buried it, it's that it's been there for 100 or more years, and it just sort of ended up there.
Yeah. Bottom line, it is advised to have a survey done, especially if they're a purchaser. It is not the seller's responsibility necessarily if they are looking to sell a property to have one done, because I do get that question asked of me from off-island buyers. Isn't it the seller's responsibility? As per our sale agreements, the seller will provide, if available, a survey or a plot plan if available, but will not guarantee its use, I believe is exactly how that clause is written. So if you are concerned with property boundaries, trying to determine how much I own, where does this property end, is there something encroaching on your property, we advise getting a survey done.
Looking at properties, cottages, recreational properties, any properties, acreage this time of the year, this being March, things are still kind of frozen, frost is just coming out of the ground. Is this a good time to look with reference to bugs, particularly mosquitoes and black flies?
No, you're not going to see a lot of bugs at this time of the year yet. That's going to come in about another month and a half. By May, you'll start seeing them.
I had a piece of property last year, and this is not the first piece, that I got eaten alive. And this area is known for high concentrations of flies, black flies, mosquitoes, so bad as much as the builders that were building homes in there were wearing mosquito netting. So I'm thinking to myself, if I'm looking at these properties and it's March or January or something, everything's frozen, I'm not really getting a good representation of the property because I could get eaten alive by the time I take possession of it in the spring. So something to be cautious about. I don't know how you can remedy that. You can ask people for their opinions, but one person's opinion on the amount of bugs in another might be two different things. You can look for screened-in rooms, which we've talked about in previous podcasts. But all in all, it could be kind of a dangerous venture.
Yeah, if that is something that would be a concern, depending on your usage of the property, you definitely want to look for those kind of signs. Google Street View, even if you're able to, if it's a cottage area, you won't be able to.
We're going to see bugs?
The screened-in porch, you're not going to see bugs. And also for clarification, I'm originally from Ontario, as you are as well, Michael, but black flies usually imply the bigger-sized flies. These black flies that we have on PEI are tiny little flies. They look very cute. However, they do end up taking chunks of skin when they bite you. So they are very problematic. I have been attacked by them many times over the years, and I would prefer not to be in those areas.
And if you're dealing with an experienced real estate agent that has dealt in properties in that specific area, they should know what the bug level is like.
Yeah, ask your realtor. That is another advantage instead of trying to navigate your way through the buying process, assuming that you can do this on your own because you've bought many properties and you feel that you're savvy. You're missing out on a lot of valuable information that a local realtor would be able to provide to you.
And if we wanted to maximize the amount of bugs on a viewing, when would we go?
Usually the evening or early morning, dawn or dusk.
And what would the wind be at speed-wise?
Well, that's a question, Michael, I'll throw back to you.
Zero.
Okay.
Bugs don't like wind. They don't like open areas. They like treed-in areas, and they like things to be still. So something to keep in mind when you're looking at properties. Not great to own a property that you can't even exit your door without getting eaten alive, or your poor dogs can't go for a walk without being attacked by mosquitoes. It's not nice. I don't know why people build properties and cottages in these areas, but it's not something I'd want to do. I've been in areas where you couldn't even get out of your vehicle because they're attacking the windshields.
So you just buy yourself a hazmat suit.
Could be. And if the name of your street is Itch a Bit, there's probably bugs.
There's probably a reason. And not to say, yep, perhaps even look at the name of the street. It could be something that, historically speaking, may have had a reputation of something.
Do not buy a property on Black Fly Alley or Mosquito Lane. Comparing area to C to area A, when you're looking at establishing a price in area A, which is?
Area A is Western Prince Edward Island.
So anything west of Summerside, would you typically take in data from area C, which is conveniently the center of the island?
Yes, in between Summerside and Charlottetown, or the North South Shore area is what the region used to be called. No, you wouldn't be. The data is very different. You would not use that if you're looking at trying to establish a comparable or comparative market analysis on a property.
I had somebody that called and they had a property they paid, let's just say hypothetically, $80,000-$90,000 for, and now they think it's worth $500,000. And their argument was properties in the middle of the island and Cavendish and Rustico and areas like that were selling for that kind of money. So their property had to be worth the same because it wasn't that far away. even though it was probably about a 45 or 30 minute drive or more.
Yeah, and Prince Edward Island, as much as we're small, a dollar on Eastern PEI is very different from a dollar, say, in Charlottetown, which is Region E, or a dollar in North-South Shore, Region C. So you really need to, again, I'm just stressing again the value of having a realtor and one that actually knows what they're talking about. Your realtor should not be using data from a completely different region to try to establish a price on your property.
And if you are doing a reverse CMA, in other words, you're trying to determine the value on a property you're buying, make sure the comparables are close to the property you're buying, not 50 miles away.
Well, it goes back to that, what's the number one thing in real estate that's the most important? And that's location, location, location. Well, as much as that location is applicable if you're looking to purchase a property, it's also applicable when you're trying to establish value. You want to only be using properties that are in that same location, not on a completely different region or area.
Next, we come to the highlight, or the pivotal point of the whole show, is Patty is going to tell us how overpricing a listing, a property you're selling, may end up with a lower sale price.
Yeah, and I encounter this a lot, and I'm sure you have many, many times over the years, Michael, but people always say that they can come down, but they can't go back up. So they try to price the property a little bit higher and then hope to see that they can generate a buyer at that more inflated price. What that essentially ends up doing is causing the property to sit longer on the market. So you end up with more days on market. And then you have buyers who may be interested in it. They end up favoriting the property on realtor.ca and they watch for the price to come down. And as Canadians, we're pretty patient people, so we will sit and watch for as long as it takes for that inflated property to come down to a realistic property price. Now, we're talking an average person, you know, buyer looking to for their own usage. We're not talking investor pricing. If you overprice your property, you will end up sitting more days on market and taking less than you would if you were to price it at market value. You will generate a stronger number of buyers and interest, possibly even a multiple offer situation, which only requires two buyers to be considered a multiple offer. We're not talking 20, 30 plus offers. And you'll end up getting more money in your pocket than you would by pricing it high and trying to hope that someone is willing to pay a higher price. It does cost you, plus the cost to carry the extra days on market, the buyer sitting and holding out. Now they're also wondering, what's wrong with this product? It becomes like stale bread on the shelf. There must be something wrong. How many showings have you had? Have you received any offers? As the days on market go up, the increase in those questions from other buyers or other agents start to surface.
Which brings me to my next point, which is, how many times have you had a property that's been grossly overpriced? Everyone has established it's grossly overpriced compared to local comparables. But when you ask the vendors or the sellers to lower the price, they give you the old, well, Patty, if you don't believe in the price, we're going to list with another agent. Is that not the dumbest thing you've ever heard?
Yes. And that is why I send an email out. Once I'm done, there is a whole process in determining and establishing a price estimate of net for a property owner. Once that price has been established, and it's not my opinion, it is my interpretation of the data on the MLS. I do try to collaboratively establish this price with the seller. Once that price is determined and we've come up with a range, we are not appraisers, so we should not be giving one number. We should be giving a range of low, medium, and high about the market
time
range.
Time as well.
And time, absolutely. But in this market, with there being pretty much the entire island being around, for residential properties, 60 days, it is applicable, again, if you're in the $1 million plus properties, there's a fewer buyer pool up there, so the days on market are going to be a little higher. However, if you are establishing a price I send off an email, so I'm always able to refer back to that in future conversations to circumvent that exact issue, Michael, that you bring up, that a seller's coming back saying, I don't believe in the price. It's nothing to do with me not believing in the price. I'd love to give every single client of mine $100,000, $200,000 over market value for their property. It's just most times banks will not agree to overfund or finance a property, and many buyers are not interested in overpaying as well. So they're not interested in paying for your credit card bills, paying off your car, giving you a vacation, and allowing you to buy that more expensive house.
But what you're really doing when you set up that initial report that you stockpile is you get to play I told you so.
Yes, absolutely. And I will reference or refer back to that many times if I have to, if they're asking me, why haven't we received any showings? Why haven't we received any offers? What's going on? Maybe you should update your photos. Maybe you should put this picture that I took at Christmas time 5 years ago because it makes the house look so nice, and put that in your marketing picture because that picture will get it sold. I know we've encountered that in the past, Michael. Or we need summer pictures. We need pictures that have clips of their house because they liked the way the flower bed looked on that corner, and they're desperate to try to see what they can do to get it sold. Whereas at the end of the day, it came down to price. If your agent has hired a professional and put together an attractive marketing representation.
Overpriced sellers are usually the highest maintenance ones, and they usually end up going through two or three different agents, and hopefully your agent number two or three when they finally lowered that price down to market. And assuming the marketing is good, the property sells. Next here, what do we have? You have two building lots you want to sell. Do you sell them together as one package or separately to maximize your return?
I actually bring that on with three packages. I sell the lots individually because that will maximize the return to the seller if we can sell those lots individually. But I also will package them together just in case someone's looking for a larger piece of land, or if there is a developer and they love that particular area, we may luck out and get both of them sold. Or if it's family and they want the children and the grandparents or whatever the situation is to be able to purchase and possess both of those properties for future development.
Good answer. Moving on. You're a conspiratorial agent. You're representing a purchaser, and you want to know if it's possible for you to be with the vendor's agent when your offer or the offers, if it's a multiple offer situation, is presented. May that be in person, or considering this is 2025, maybe it's over a Zoom or a Skype call or whatever. Is that a possibility?
Oh, you're absolutely allowed as a buyer's agent to present your own offer to a seller.
If the seller
agrees to it.
Right. The seller can just say no. In that case, you have to wonder why they're saying no.
No, I would find it's no different than a seller being in the home when a buyer and a buyer's agent is showing it. You don't want to give away your poker face. You don't want to. I don't feel it's a good idea. I wouldn't be interested in having agents present their client's offer to me. If they wanted to do a video and present it to me and perhaps give me a representation of who they are, but the uncomfortableness of having them right in my face, looking and relying on my facial expressions, my response, I need time to process. I think a video would do very well, but I don't really care for the other. But it is the seller's choice.
It doesn't usually happen. I have been in situations where I have presented offers with the purchaser's agent there, and it worked out great. And actually, it was her offer that won the contest, so to speak.
Well, that's good for them to have been able to do that. But again, I think the same could be achieved with a letter from the buyer.
Ah, letter schmetter.
Love letters for houses. I love that.
I find that most of the time vendors just ignore them.
Probably most, but every once in a while there's something. It depends on the is this an emotional home for these particular property owners? They want to make sure that somebody else is going to love the home the same way they did, or raise their family in it, or they have the same dog, you know, the same dog breed as, you know, the property owners. If they can connect with them, if there's some sort of connection, that letter could be very powerful.
So what you're saying is when you write these letters, you have your purchasers follow the vendors around and join the same church, go to the same stores, recognize what kind of dogs they have, and then basically emulate that in their letter to draw parallels?
No, I do not advise my clients to stalk them, whether physically or on social media. But there are telltale signs when you look at a house. They may have a picture of their dog sitting on a table, or, and you may not even know what
the dog is sitting on the table, and they get a picture of it?
Of the dog sitting on a side table, Michael. There usually is something, some sort of connection. If there's not, and it's just, this is the house you want, I'm not saying every single time it is appropriate to be writing letters, but in some situations, especially if you're in a multiple offer situation, it might be just that one differentiating factor that might help you win out on a property.
And one thing you can do, rather than writing a letter, if it's just say, well, you could write a letter. If it's not a multiple offer situation, you could also include a CMA, which would justify, hopefully, what you're offering on the property.
If you're coming in low, absolutely.
I am.
Okay.
So I'm trying to justify what I'm offering based on the sales data that I and my agent and I found to justify our so-called lowball offer to say, hey, your property's overpriced, and this is why you're offering this, and here's my little letter.
Yeah, especially if the listing agent is not able to provide back a CMA as to why they priced the property at that price point. If they're not able to provide that, then absolutely you do a reverse CMA and include that to be able to justify, because maybe the seller hasn't been properly advised and this might be a bit of an eye-opener and may also help you with supporting facts as to why, and not to take it emotionally or personally that someone doesn't feel your house is of value.
Security risks. We talked about this before. Somebody calls you up. He's got a creepy, dark voice. Sounds kind of raspy. And he wants to see a property at 9 o'clock at night, and it has no electricity, no heat. It's abandoned. It's out in a 40-acre field somewhere in the backwoods. Do you ask him a lot of questions before you go?
They don't even have to have raspy voices, Michael. I've actually gone through this where I have had sounding like a very polished, put together. In this instance, it was a male individual. And I did request an office meeting so that I could meet with my client, see who he was, perhaps collect his ID. The homes were all very isolated homes that were on his list with no electricity, and he did want to see them in the evening hours. He did not end up buying anything on PEI and ended up leaving, but not before he caused me to have to go in hiding for about a month because it turned very bad.
And as a female agent, one of the things you can do is you can have a male agent come with you on those showings or opt to have them during the day. One thing I would probably do is get a copy of their ID. We need it for FinTrack anyway, so you're just not going out there all willy-nilly and ending up as the next victim, which has happened numerous times to real estate agents in North America.
Yeah, or have your spouse go with you on a viewing where they're sitting in the vehicle while you're showing the property, just knowing that there's somebody else there. These electronic devices, as much as it's nice, you may say, oh, well, I have, you know, Apple's Find My or Life 360.
Find your dead body.
Well, no, actually, Michael, and that's a really good point. And what I'm about to get at, it doesn't show or tell where your body is. It only tells where your phone is. And that's very concerning.
So the little emoji doesn't fall over?
No, it doesn't. But what? Something to keep in mind, because people assume, well, this is going to let them know where I am. No, that only lets them know where your phone is, not where you physically are.
And they could just take your phone and toss it.
Absolutely.
The term assignee. I had to use that on a, well, it was kind of a bizarro situation. I don't know if I should share this.
I don't know. What is it?
I have a friend slash business partner that wanted to buy a house, but he was in Arizona and it was at night and I had other things going on. So I told him that I will write the offer, but I'll put it in my name. I'll buy the house and I'll make this contract assignable. So essentially, at the end of the day, I could have ended up with this house, which I didn't care if I did because it was actually a really good deal.
Yeah, I believe you were discussing this one on the previous episode.
We didn't cover it all, but what it was is it was a house that was on, it was a disaster. These people were old, probably suffered from dementia or whatever the case may be. And rather than doing what they should have done, which is get a dumpster and just clean this house from top to bottom, they asked the agent, what price should we put this on to get it sold quick? They put it on for a nothing asking price. I said to my friend business partner, I said, you're going to come in probably 75% above ask. I said, if you really, really want the house and you don't want to lose it, come in at 100% over. We offered 50% over. There was just under 30 offers and it sold at 68.3% over ask. So my 75% was pretty accurate.
Yeah. And so did you put in and or assignee just because of the time zone difference and the...
I put or assignee because I signed the contract. I put my name or assignee so I could take that contract and flip it out to somebody else because it may have not ended up with him. We had probably another party or two that may have been interested to pick it up as a flip. But in the meantime, I just needed to get an offer on the table to get the house, and that's what I did. And I'm not suggesting anyone does this, but that's why people use or assignee, because they can get the contract, and then you can take that contract and put it in any name you want, or you can flip it out, which is why the banks don't want to see that on a contract, because it can also be used for mortgage fraud. You've heard of that?
Yes. The other thing, though, to put and or assignee is if you're purchasing a property at this juncture under your personal name, but you want to transfer it over to a corporation and you're still in the process of doing that, especially if it's a cottage business or something along that line. Those are reasons why we typically see and or assignee as well on purchase and sale agreements.
Or they're going to create a new corporation to put that entity in. However, they do need to talk to the people holding their financing because they may not want to see that, or you may have to amend the contract to remove that assignee.
Yeah, absolutely. If they need financing.
Last question for Powerhouse Patty. What does a clean offer mean? I said this to my business partner. So we're going to put a clean offer in. So basically the offer that we put in was, this is how much we're willing to pay. There's no home inspection, water test, anything, financing, what else? Septic inspection. There's no conditions. It was clean. Here's your money. It's 50% above ask. We'll close as soon as the paperwork can be done. So what's a clean offer is what he asked.
Clean offer. My interpretation of a clean offer is an offer, hopefully a mutually agreeable closing date, a whatever the purchase price is with no conditions aside from title search. That would be a clean offer. If a person needs financing and they're confident they have financing approved, it is on a well, I would advise them to at least leave the well test in, because it is something that some lenders will say, because you removed the water test clause, we're not going to finance this property until you reinstate it. I've seen that done many times, but a clean offer, no conditions, just title search.
But if you're coming in against 25 other buyers, there's going to be probably a third or a quarter of those are going to be professional investors like us that are going to put it in perfectly clean with nothing. So to bring in an offer subject to financing or water test is just not going to do it. And I can understand a lot of purchasers would be nervous about doing that.
Yeah, I've been on, because predominantly I'm a listing agent, and that's about 60-70% of my business is listings. And I've received multiple offers, up to 11, 13 offers on a property. And I cannot believe how many different ways a contract can be constructed. It just blew my mind on, oh, that's an interesting tactic. Here's a different tactic. There's many ways to write an offer, but at the end of the day, which is what this topic is about, a clean offer, it's just, here's the price, here's the closing. Yes, we need title search. We want a clear title, meaning that no one's name still exists. There's no liens or anything on the property. And it would be a done deal if the seller were to sign and agree to it.
Here's a tricky question for you. What about an accelerated offer?
An accelerated offer? Are you talking about an escalation clause?
Yes.
Okay.
So just for the people that don't know what this is, an escalation clause basically means that I will offer, say, $10,000 or whatever I decide over and above what anybody else offers. These offers are illegal in PEI and most other places. However, they're still written and they're accepted. Why are they illegal?
Well, under the Realtor Code, we're not allowed to disclose any content or detail within any other offers. Not even the seller's approval, we're not allowed to disclose it. So in order for an escalation clause to be exercised, the price of another buyer's offer would have to be disclosed in order to say, here is, and in your example, $10,000 above. So we are not allowed to, and our Realtor Code is nationwide. It is not just something that's provincial. We all have to adhere to the Canadian Real Estate Association's code, as well as each association provincially and however many within each province, a lot of times have their own code of ethics.
So no escalation clauses if you're in multiple offers. There's been multiple lawsuits in multiple provinces and states. Patty, let's wrap it up from our remote location here, coming to you from Powerhouse Realty, PEI International, Canada.
Yes. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Michael and Patty Show, otherwise known as MAPS, guiding and navigating you through the buying and selling process and everything Prince Edward Island. If there is anything that you would like to see us include, as Michael mentioned at the beginning of this episode, please feel free to reach out to us. You can find us on a variety of different platforms, all in which we use to market and promote properties and also to promote Prince Edward Island, because that's where the first, you have to be sold on moving to PEI before you're sold on a house.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to follow or subscribe to the show. Give us a star rating, which would be 5 stars or more, and some feedback. Thanks again. Goodbye for now.
Have a great day.